It's philosophy talk.
Coach.
Yes, Frank?
Where do I go?
Proceed to the hub.
Machine learning algorithms are all around us these days.
They're being used for everything from movie recommendations to sentencing in criminal court.
But can algorithms really be objective when they're created by human programmers?
I guess I just don't see the point in something that short. 12 hours.
Even your reaction to a brief encounter provides a system with valuable information.
Yeah, well, I don't even do anything. The system thinks I'm a prude.
The system makes no moral judgments.
Machine learning algorithms pick up the biases of society.
Would you trust your life, your fortune, your child to an algorithm?
But it always finds your perfect match.
In 99.8% of cases.
I have to go through loads of relationships to find it.
That is correct.
Our guest is Angèle Christin from Stanford University.
The morality of algorithms.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher. Thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thanks so much for being our partner. You've supported us in the past, and we're really grateful for that support. But we need your help now more than ever.
So here's what you do. Go to our website, philosophytalk.org, click the donate button, and help us make more of what we know you love.
Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating. Would you be willing to trust your life to an algorithm?
Well, aren't computers less prone to bias than human beings?
Do we really want to turn over our moral agency to software?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ken teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
And today we're thinking about the ethics of algorithms.
Ethics of algorithms? Isn't that a contradiction in terms, Ken?
No, why would you say that, Josh?
Well, algorithms aren't moral agents. And yet, in spite of that, we seem to be turning over morally fraught decisions over to them at just an alarming rate.
Alarming? Really? I mean, we can put computers in charge of air traffic control a long time ago, and that made air travel safer for everybody. There's nothing alarming about that.
Yeah, okay, but all that software had to do was keep the planes far enough apart so they wouldn't bump into each other. Give me something more challenging.
Okay, take the new frontier of this stuff. Self-driving cars. I mean, all those crowded city streets with cars and pedestrians and cyclists traveling every which way. Yeah, and in much closer proximity to each other than planes ever get. What about that example?
Well, that's a good example. For me, I mean, do you really want computers to decide when your car should swerve to avoid a pedestrian, maybe killing you or your passenger?
Well, Josh, I got to tell you, it doesn't really matter what I want. It doesn't really matter what you want, because the day is coming, dude, and it's coming fast.
Too fast, if you ask me. I mean, look, computers are already in almost complete control of the stock market. They are gradually taking over medical diagnosis, and some people even want to turn sentencing decisions over to them. It's out of control.
Out of control, Josh? Come on. Why on earth would you trust a fallible human judge over a well-programmed computer? I mean, have you seen the mess that judges have made of sentencing decisions?
Well, at least judges are living, breathing human beings with a sense of duty and responsibility and empathy.
Yeah, and racial biases and hidden political agendas and overblown emotional reactions. Just look, with a computer, you just encode the sentencing guidelines that, you know, we decided to put into the law. You encode those into your algorithm, and then you set back, and the computer will decide without fear or favoritism. That's vastly superior to a judge.
Okay, but who's going to program those computers to play judge?
Well, human beings, of course.
Oh, the same human beings with those racial biases and hidden agendas?
Oh, I was talking about the judges. I wasn't talking about the programmers.
Oh, so programmers are less biased than judges all of a sudden, right? So they're like Mr. Spock, all green blood, no emotions.
No. Look, programmers, although some of them may seem like it, they're not Vulcans. They're humans too. But my point is that we can train them not to write their biases into their algorithms.
But how? I mean, most of us aren't even aware of our biases.
Well, even if we're not, at least we can test and debug and tweak the programs. Josh, you can't rewrite a judge's neural code when you discover that the dude's got this thing against black people? So look, give me the computer over the judge any day of the week.
I just think it's harder than you imagine to get our biases out of these algorithms. I mean, consider the machine learning algorithms that are all the rage these days.
Yeah, they are all the rage. You got something against machine learning, Josh?
Well, the problem is that you don't anymore program every single line of code, right, like they used to in the old days. Instead, you basically give the computer a problem and let it figure out how to solve it on its own.
It's a beautiful technique. It's a really powerful technique, making all kinds of advances. What's your problem?
My problem is this. Let's say you got a bunch of tech bros in Silicon Valley, and they pick their friends to be the training sample. You can be darn sure they won't be representative of the population
yeah, okay,
at large.
Okay, look, I've got no brief for tech bro culture, but look, you just have to make sure to use statistically sound methods to design your training sets for these things. We know how to do that. We know how to do good statistics.
Yeah, but it doesn't end there, Ken. I mean, look, think about it this way. Machine learning algorithms are also often black boxes. They're inscrutable. You can't see what's going on in there. And that means that if something goes wrong, you can't get in there, like you were saying we should, to tweak and debug, right? I mean, look, I was no huge fan of old-fashioned AI, but at least you knew what the software was doing.
So Josh, let me get this straight, okay? You really long for the days when humans were in charge of all these decisions. If you can't have those days, you'll take the good old-fashioned AI programs from, 30 years ago or something. But the last thing you want to deal with is the newfangled machine learning algorithms taking over. I got to tell you something, Josh. You sound a little like a Luddite, my friend.
No. Look, I think technology is wonderful. I'm just not in a hurry to farm our moral agency out to machines.
Well, look, whether you want it or not, whether I want it or not, it's happening, Josh. Courtrooms around the country, for example, are turning to computers for advice on who should stay behind bars while awaiting trial. And so we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to see the process up close. She files this report.
That'll be your next court date, sir, tomorrow morning.
Judge Ross Moody is inside a San Francisco courtroom, robed up for an afternoon of bail hearings.
Calling the matter of line 602.
First to take the stand is a man charged with carrying a loaded gun in public. The defense attorney argues that the defendant has a stable job and always makes his court dates.
So I'm asking that he be given an opportunity to be released while this case is pending.
The prosecutor argues the man only showed up because what other option did he have? The suspect was already in jail at the time. He says he went on to commit another crime once released.
And the fact that he was again walking with a loaded firearm with an extended magazine shows he's a serious threat to public safety.
Judge Moody has three options. Detain the defendant until trial, let the defendant go free until then, or ask that he pay a big chunk of cash for his freedom. But before Judge Moody decides, he looks at a recommendation from an algorithm. The one this court uses bases its recommendations on the case histories of more than 1.5 million people, taking into account the person's age, criminal history, and record of showing up in court. The algorithm, also called a public safety assessment, says, let the man go.
This is one of those cases where I disagree very strongly with public safety assessment. I think that the public safety threat is self-evident. So I'm not going to follow the PSA today. I'm going to follow the recommendation of the prosecutor. I'm going to set bail at $150,000 on an open felony.
So we're not turning courtroom decisions over to algorithms just yet. San Francisco District Attorney George Gascone introduced this tool to the city's courtrooms in 2016. He wanted to bring more fairness to money bail decisions.
One of the concerns that I have with money bail is it really creates two systems. It creates a system for the people that can afford to post bail and a system for those that cannot.
Even with help from a computer, judges ultimately decide who to release before trial. A defendant's shot at freedom depends on who is on the bench. According to research, female judges and Democrats are more lenient. Another study shows judges are more forgiving after snack breaks. Gascone has faith in the consistency of algorithms.
The reality is that you have a system that has developed a body of knowledge that is way superior to what a human being will ever be able to do.
But not everyone trusts the machines. In July 2018, more than 100 civil rights groups signed a paper expressing concern the algorithm is biased. San Francisco's algorithm, designed by a nonprofit called the Laura and John Arnold Foundation, weighs a defendant's criminal history. San Francisco public defender Chase Boudin is worried about how the algorithm calculates risk.
Someone who's been stopped by the police numerous times because of the color of their skin. Someone who's pled guilty to previous crimes because they were too poor to bail out. In other words, the exact people that the Arnold Foundation seeks to protect by implementing this new tool are prejudiced because of the built-in legacy of prejudice and racism in our criminal justice system.
So, do we trust the humans or the computers? Shard Goyle is a professor of engineering at Stanford who studies algorithms. He and his researchers found that risk assessment tools are more likely to be accurate at predicting risk than the people are. But he says humans can see nuances that computers can't.
When a defendant comes to court, they expect that their particular individual story will be heard and a decision will be made on the basis of that.
More broadly, Goyle says that though algorithms can be helpful guides, they can't completely fix disparities in the criminal justice system.
My worry is that people will strictly use algorithms and not consider broader policy fixes. For example, eliminating money bail in entirety.
States like New Jersey already have. Since eliminating the money bail system, that state's jail population has dropped dramatically. People in the bail industry, like reality TV star Dog the Bounty Hunter, have since sued the state over bail reform. In those cases, the judge has ruled on New Jersey's side. But the judge is human. Next time, maybe try asking a machine.
I just want my guy right now. I just want somebody that's wanted.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks, Holly, for that guided tour of the new frontier of algorithmic decision-making, the courtroom. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Joshua Landy. And today we're asking about the ethics of algorithms.
We're joined now by Angèle Christin, professor of communication at Stanford University and author of Algorithms in Practice, Comparing Web Journalism and Criminal Justice. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Angèle.
Thank you.
So, Angèle, you're in communications, and I understand you're a sociologist by training. You're not a computer scientist. So what first got you interested in this question about the ethics of algorithms?
I've been studying criminal justice for a long time. When I was a student in France, I did this long fieldwork in prisons and jails and criminal courts in the outskirts of Paris. And I've been doing a lot of interviews with judges and prosecutors, asking them how they make decisions, right? I mean, it's a big decision to send someone to jail. How can you be sure that you're right? And what I realized at that point was that judges and prosecutors didn't know, and they were worried about it. They were just like, I'm not sure I'm making the right call. And so when I realized recently that algorithms were being developed to precisely help judges and prosecutors make these decisions, I decided to go look into it.
That's, yeah, wow. I mean, yeah, I agree. It's a really serious issue. I'm curious about, you know, we were talking in the opening, Ken and I, about the question whether bias can creep into algorithms. But, you know, definitionally, an algorithm is just a step-by-step mechanical procedure for solving some kind of computational problem. So what does it even mean to say that an algorithm can be biased?
Yeah, in a way, that definition of algorithm, I mean, it's a proper definition, but it's a bit not helpful, no? Because, okay, it's a procedure, but who creates a procedure? Well, it's right. A human being. Who decides on the step-by-step process that leads to an output? Well, it's a human being. Who decides on the output? It's also a human being. And who is affected by the algorithm in general? Well, it's also a human being.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I think there are kind of two notions of algorithms out there. There's the one that you'll find in a computer science textbook, right, which is just this step-by-step procedure, you know? It's like long division is an algorithm. You know, if you follow the rules, you'll get the right answer. That's what algorithms are. That's in the mathematical computer science sense. But there's another sense. It's like any kind of decision procedure that can be automated. And then some of these decisions that we automate, they don't have definite answers, right? And we just turn over the making of an answer to the automation. That's kind of tricky.
Absolutely. And I think that's a big deal with algorithms, which is that in order to have an algorithm, you need to have a clear goal, right? Because an algorithm is always going to optimize for some kind of output. But in some cases, the output is complex, and people are not clear about what's going on there.
Right. So you think about the bail case that Holly was talking about a moment ago. Presumably, you could optimize either for maximum public safety, where nobody gets bail, or you could optimize for maximum opportunity to for people to mend their lives and things like that.
I think actually talking about this stuff in terms of algorithmic decision making actually does a kind of disservice, because it makes us think, well, there's a mathematical function that determines who gets bail and who doesn't get bail. There isn't a mathematical function that's already there that determines, and you just apply this procedure and you compute that function. That's a fiction, right?
And following up on what you just said, Josh, I mean, I think that, you know, really, so yeah, you could optimize for public safety. You could optimize for fairness, making sure that two different defendants with kind of similar characteristics are getting the same kind of sentence. And you could optimize for rehabilitation, just giving a chance, giving a shot at people to kind of reinsert themselves into society. And these are three different goals
and
that...
Absolutely.
And that's completely up to us. And we'll have to dig more deeply into this. This is, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're asking about the morality and ethics of algorithms with Angèle Cristin from Stanford University.
Would you rather have a doctor or a computer diagnose your illness? Do you want software deciding who should go to jail and for how long? Would you trust your life to an algorithm?
Algorithms, to trust or not to trust. Plus your calls and emails if you're not a bot when Philosophy Talk continues. Crime, travel, communications, entertainment, all managed for you by your friendly neighborhood algorithm. I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and we're thinking today about the morality of algorithms. Our guest is Angèle Cristin from Stanford University.
So, Angèle, I want to take you back to the debate Josh and I were having at the beginning. Josh clearly thinks it's a recipe for moral disaster that we're turning more and more morally fraught decisions over to computers and their algorithms. I think it's the wave of the future. I think it's often a good thing, maybe mostly a good thing. Whose side are you on?
In the case of criminal justice, I think I'm on Josh's side.
Excellent.
Yes. So for several reasons, right? But first, I think, you know, what you, in the interview with Sharad Goel, he was saying, you know, fixing on algorithm kind of distracts us from some of the bigger policy questions. And I think in the case of criminal justice, this is absolutely true.
So you think in other areas like medicine, for example, it's fine and maybe even a good thing.
It's not just a maybe even a good thing. I got to say, I don't know what you're going to say. It's definitely a good thing. Computers right now, although we haven't turned medical diagnosis completely over to them, right now can out-diagnose a doctor by a mile. And eventually, right now there's a lot of computer-aided diagnosis going on. Eventually, it's all going to be computerized.
But again, that's because the output is simple. Like, you don't want, I mean, it's pretty easy. You want people to be healthy. You don't want them to get sick. You don't want them to die. Everybody's kind of on the same page as far as the output is concerned. Whereas in the case of criminal justice, it's much more complicated.
I mean, there's still some complications about how many, do you want to optimize for false positives or false negatives? So it's not 100% straightforward.
Well, right.
But I agree with you, at least the values are simple. The value is health.
Yeah.
Well, and there's a yes and a no of it. Do you have this disease or not? And you can just test it. Whether who misdiagnoses more? The human physician misdiagnoses more. That's where all this medical, a lot of the medical malpractice comes from. Not all of it. Mistreatment is some of it, but misdiagnosis is a lot of it. And it's just a fact. The machine-assisted diagnosis is much better than just a plain human.
And you have a very clear test, as you were saying. Whereas in the case of criminal justice, I mean, the question of false positives, false negatives, like, that's just more complicated because, I mean, you know, for example, when you're giving a risk score to someone and then you send them to jail, and then you're like, oh, well, they engage in recidivism, therefore we were right to give them a high risk score. Well, yeah, but in the meantime, the person went to jail. And we know that people in jail are much more likely to reoffend afterwards because they create they're in a network of criminals, et cetera. Right? And so that's something that the algorithm doesn't take into account.
And that thing that somebody said in Holly's piece about the data set is already infected and it's, I said to Josh, well, we just do statistical sound methods and we'll get out the bias in the data set. But with a historical data set on the basis of which you're bound to have to train these people, you can't just invent a new data set. It's already got all this built-in history of segregation and discrimination.
Exactly. I mean, you know, look at the arrest rate for African-Americans for drug offenses compared to Caucasians. I mean, it's astronomically higher, and not because they're offending more, right? So if you just set an algorithm out to look, to examine the world as it's currently constituted, it's just going to encode the biases of society.
Absolutely. And that's also because arrest data doesn't equal crime, right? And arrest doesn't equal crime. There are a lot of crimes out there where people don't get arrested.
Yeah.
And vice versa, a lot of people get arrested even though they didn't commit a crime. And so here you get the kind of social construction of data problem, which is that data sets never emerge in a vacuum. They're always dependent on a specific set of institution. In that case, it's the police forces, for example, right? Another problem, I think, and like that's, you know, we talked about that a bit, is also that some variables that are put into the data sets can also serve as proxies for race. And so in the case of San Francisco that you had in your segment, you know, there weren't such variables, but for example, with Compass, which is one of the most widely used risk assessment tools in the countries, there are many variables about, like, for example, do you have friends who have a criminal record? Now, that kind of question, in fact, serves as a proxy for race.
So even if you try to eliminate race from your data set, or at least from the way in which you're analyzing the data set, it can creep back in.
So this is something that comes with these machine learning algorithms, which, as Josh said, are the rage. They're kind of taking over this this domain. In the old days, it wasn't really that long ago, in the old days of good old-fashioned artificial intelligence, as people used to call it, where what you try to do is stuff a lot of human-like knowledge into the thing in the algorithm through what was called knowledge representation, you would do this thing that I said. You would think, okay, the law says these are the factors, and these are the weights of the factors, and you'd write every line of code. You wouldn't let the machine figure out on its own what to weigh and how much. I mean, that just turned out to be really hard, right? Stuffing the human-like knowledge into the machine. That just turned out to be really, really hard. And then these deep learning things took over, right? Where the old-fashioned approaches failed. But it sounds like maybe that old-fashioned approach would be more acceptable in some ways, less morally problematic, because we would do what Josh, we would do. We know what we put in there. We know what weight we assign. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think that, yes, that's a very good point, especially as far as accountability is concerned. So, like, you know, in the case of criminal justice, basically when you get a sentence, like, you are able to appeal, right? And that's a very big deal. Whereas in the case of algorithms, you're not able to appeal. If you have a risk score on your back, well, usually you don't know that you have a risk score on your back. You don't know what it is. And if it's wrong, it's really hard to get it fixed. So I think that's a question of accountability in that case, and responsibility is very different for machines and humans.
Yeah, I want to say one point about that, and then I want to get to some callers, but there's one point about that. Here's another thing about machine learning that we haven't focused on a lot, because they set the weights themselves. They use various algorithms for readjusting their weights in light of their error signals. Some of them are really opaque.
Yeah.
Right. You have no idea how they're representing the data set, what weights they're assigning, or why they give you an answer, but why they gave you that answer? It's like, I don't know. So here's the thing I worry about when these, there are people working on this problem, but here's the thing I worry about. When these things take over everything, and for example, that self-driving car drives into a pedestrian and kills him, and somebody wants to sue the company, and they want to try and diagnose the algorithm and find out why it did what it did, what's going to happen?
Nobody knows.
And the companies usually don't want to reveal the codes, right? Because they're like, listen, this is intellectual property. That's our business. Why should we give you the codes that we use to categorize these cases, right? Or to make this decision? So there is also, I mean, you have different kinds of opacity, really. You have one which is that nobody knows what the algorithm is doing because it's machine learning, and so it's evolving on its own, and it's really complicated, etc. But you also have kind of corporate secrecy.
Right.
So how does a defendant mount a defense? I mean, usually a defendant knows what the arguments are, right, that the prosecution's making. What happens now?
That's a very good question.
Yeah.
So actually, I talked with lawyers, with defense attorneys, who told me that they are buying the algorithms themselves in order to replicate the process through which defendants get categorized, in order to help their clients basically assess their chances, right, before they go in front of the prosecutor and the judge. So there is that option.
So you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the ethics of algorithms. We'd love to have you join this conversation. And Cheyenne, I think that's how you say it, from Alameda is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Cheyenne. Did I say that right?
Hi, thank you. Yeah, my name's Cheyenne.
Cheyenne, okay.
Yeah. Well, I was going to make a comment just about how imbued with racial bias the justice system is in any of the data we have from, you know, from beginning to end, from the birth and the history of the racial justice system and the way it operates on a daily basis. But I'm, you know, a lot of those points have been made while I've been waiting online, and I'm just wondering, I'm wondering about the racial bias inherent in using the racial justice system and, you know, data on traffic accidents as two sort of reasonable examples to talk about algorithms, and that even that racial that the criminal justice system is part of the conversation is evidence of racial bias. This is a system that is so broken and so born of racial bias, and the research is so abundantly clear that it would even be held up as an example.
Yeah, Cheyenne, you're making a good point, and I'm going to put it to Angela in a different way, because the people who are gung-ho this kind of thing, they say, well, right, Cheyenne's right, but here's a way to begin to overcome this system, right? Because look, where does that racial bias come from? It comes from human beings and this, that, and the other thing. And the thing I was saying to Josh is at least there's a prospect of us somehow getting this stuff out of the algorithms.
But no, that's not possible. And I think Cheyenne is absolutely right. I mean, I think that using this data, which is fraught with racial prejudice from the get-go, I mean, how can you help solve a situation using the data that stems from that
very
situation?
So where do you start, though? Where do you start to correct it, though? I mean, you have to start somewhere, right? And here's the human beings, the judge increases the racial bias because he or she brings her own. The algorithm does not add to the racial bias.
Well, even that, you could kind of argue against it. For example, by saying that, like, you know, if, like, the algorithm basically categorized black people as being higher risk compared to similar white people with a similar record as being lower risk, well, then it's going to send, like, judges are going to send black people to prison much more, and then that's going to be fed back into the data, and it's going to be a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right.
So you could actually even argue that it does reinforce racial inequalities, right?
And people are going to trust it. I mean, that's the other insidious part of this.
Well,
right?
That's the part about, I say the algorithm is an honorific term. There's a positive definite procedure that will get you the right answer if you just do it in a fight. But these things aren't really algorithms. They're really kind of heuristics. I mean, looked at the problem themselves, who should go to prison and who shouldn't, how long. It's not really an algorithm for deciding that. There's a heuristic, but that heuristic imports value judgments and this, that, and the other thing. And heuristics can be challenged. Algorithms can't be challenged. They just deliver the right answer.
And yet the average person on the street like me is going to say, well, I mean, the algorithm says.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, it's objective, right?
And that's the thing, right? Because we think that algorithms are so objective, then we don't think about who is actually having an influence on the algorithm. So in the case of criminal justice, for example, you need people to fill in the variables of the defendants into the algorithms, right? And so I've been doing research, and other people have been doing research showing that the pretrial officers and the social workers who fill in the variables in the computer system, like we all do, right, being like age, sex, criminal record of the defendant, and then there is a little thing that says calculate risk. And the people who do that actually know how to manipulate the variables in order to get the results they want.
Wow. Yeah.
So, you know, you never eliminate discretion, even when you use this kind of systems, right?
Right. We've got another caller on the line, Marga from Berkeley. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Marga. What's your comment or question?
Welcome. Great. Well, I just know that as far as medicine goes, I would have been dead 8 times because the system does not, medical knowledge in general does not apply to my post-polio body or and the same thing maybe for law and decisions. Isn't the human mind more able to nuance things away from the greatest number kind of thinking?
I'm not quite. So you're opposed to medical? I'm not quite sure the gist of your question.
Oh, I'm saying that because of my own unique medical conditions, the medical knowledge is wrong. If I had trusted it, I would be dead 6 times. I'm happily alive. I happily do not believe that general knowledge of, but that's a different program.
Yeah.
What I'm saying now is also, but it's similar, aren't humans able to make wiser decisions?
No.
Because they're not just going to the general average.
I want to say something. I want to say no. I think the medical system is headed inexorably the way of the air traffic control system. A human is a node in a complicated system, right, where all this knowledge is in the system, not in the human. The system calls on the pilot when it needs to call on the pilot. The medical system is going to go the same way, and we're never going to look back, and we're all going to be better off. The medicine is headed the way of the air traffic control system.
See, but is criminal justice the same thing, though? I mean, I would argue that it's different, because justice is about individualized judgment. It's about a judge making sure that you, as an individual, deserves the sentence that you're given. Whereas algorithms, right, compare you to a group. That's what they do. They just be putting you in a class of people with similar characteristics, and then you all get the same risk score.
No, I agree with that. I would be much more uncomfortable trying to make the criminal justice system like the air traffic control system. But I actually think the air traffic control system is a wondrous thing. I mean, air travel is so much more safe than it used to be. And it's because, basically, of the role of automation in computers and the human-computer interaction. All the knowledge is in the system, and it calls on the human to exercise certain judgments at certain times, and otherwise it doesn't, right? And it's advising the guy sitting at the console, and it's suggesting trajectories and all that. And you can do the same eventually with the medical system, because you don't need all that knowledge to be in this doctor's head at this moment. It's in the system. It says to the doctor, okay, try this, intervene here. And we do want that for the medical system. So I would speak up for these guys when it talks about automating that kind of thing. But I think you're right. It doesn't follow that everything should be like that.
Right. I think one thing to bear in mind, look, you know, obviously I have my worries about a number of these systems. But, you know, one thing to bear in mind is that we can't hope for perfection, right? I mean, we've got a choice of either a set of algorithmic procedures that are going to get it right some of the time, maybe not all of the time, or a set of human beings who are also going to get it right some of the time, not all of the time. So it's not like there's a system out there of any kind that's going to produce perfect results in every single case. The question is, which is going to do a better job? And it sounds like, Angèle, you're saying medicine, yes, criminal justice system, no.
Yeah, but, you know, I don't study medicine, so I'm sure that there are, like, medical scholars who are like, no, it's awful, don't do this, right? But, like, from the outside, I would say, yeah, because just the output is simpler.
Yeah, it's simpler. Although the medicine is really complicated. It used to be cancer was regarded as a 10-factor disease. It's now a 1,000-factor disease, yeah. And doctors can't keep up with it, but the whole system can. But
value question, as Angèle was saying earlier, is much simpler.
That's true. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about the ethics of algorithms with Angèle Cristin from Stanford University.
When algorithms are biased, does the problem lie in our software or in our hearts? Shouldn't we work on eliminating our biases and blind spots so we don't offload them onto the machines?
Curing our machines by curing ourselves? When Philosophy Talk continues. Living by algorithm, does it all add up to you? I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and our guest is Angèle Cristin from Stanford University. Today, we're thinking about the morality of algorithms.
So, Angèle, I have a question that I think I don't believe the presuppositions of, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Let's say that the ultimate source of biases in our machines is always us. Then, can't we just cure our machines by curing ourselves?
I think we can train ourselves to be a bit more careful about what we feed into the system. So, you know, it depends what you call us, right? But, like, I think that training computer scientists and developers to be more careful about the kind of stuff that goes into the algorithms that they make is a valuable goal.
Yeah, I think it's a valuable goal, but the reason I don't believe it's sufficient So, oh, be a fair-minded, try and guard against your own biases. Okay, but look, you're going to use this data as your training set, which is the history of sentencing decisions in America.
Right.
And it's already got the bias built into it. Okay, you're going to do a machine learning algorithm. It's going to figure out its own biases, and it's going to give you the answers you think you want or something, right? Because this guy went back to jail, this guy didn't, blah, blah, blah. Figure out what factors were, you know?
You know, I think that training goes further than that. It's not only about fixing the models and fixing the biases. It's also about deciding that sometimes we can build things, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we should build them. Right? Mm-hmm. So in such cases, it's like, well, yeah, we could build an algorithm predicting stuff, but perhaps we shouldn't build it.
Oh, there was a case recently of a facial recognition algorithm that purported to detect sexual orientation.
No, that's our Stanford colleague.
We won't name him. No offense.
he got hammered for that.
Yeah,
that's really troubling. That's research is much more nuanced than people gave it credit to, but I got to say, he did get hammered for that.
Yeah. So question is, I mean, there are a couple of questions, right? First one is like, so is the case of like predicting sexual orientation based on pictures, like, you know, is that like, you know, accurate or not? But the second question is like, should we do that?
Exactly.
Yeah. So you mean you think there are questions about whether we should deploy a technology that's there? You don't think the technology just says, I'm here, use me.
Well,
that was a joke.
It depends on the cases. No, but I do think that sometimes, like, that, you know, right now the first step is, like, it's technical. It's always about, okay, we have to figure out the technical problem. But I think the next step is, like, well, do we need to build an algorithm for that kind of issues?
Yes.
And perhaps we should not, and we should hold off. And, you know, in order to do that, you need a specific mindset. You need a specific training to be able to kind of take a step back and be like, okay, perhaps we shouldn't build this.
I totally agree with you. We got a caller on the line. I think you're a real human and not a bot. Ryan from Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Ryan, is assuming you're a human and not a bot.
I am assuredly a human.
Okay. So what's your comment or question?
My question for the panel was, if we're concerned with racial bias in algorithms for the criminal justice system, what's to keep us from creating the algorithm to just remove that race as a data set when it's making its verdicts?
Good question.
Yeah. So people are trying to do that. Basically, they're trying to clean the algorithms from bias, right? By cleaning the data, by cleaning the variables, by cleaning the models. I mean, there is a whole section of computer science called Fairness, Accountability, and Transparency in Machine Learning, which kind of does exactly that, and they devote their whole time doing that. Now, I mean, for me, my question is like, okay, so we could clean it for race. But what about gender?
Well,
what about class? What about religion?
What
about age? What about all of these other variables? Where do we stop?
And plus, if race is a significant variable, because these things decide how to partition the data into different categories. It could discover something that's exactly coextensive with race, right? And this thing that Angel was talking about, this transparency thing, this is a really big deal because you can do these machine learning algorithms, and this is kind of how it first went, in a way that they're totally opaque what they're representing over. And because of various issues, people have started to think, well, maybe we can't have these things be so opaque. So there's lots of researchers trying to have sort of transparent machine learning, right? That's a big, big deal, but we're not there 100% yet.
And of course, it's not in the criminal justice system only. When you think about banks, I mean, who gets a loan? There are algorithms for that too. And again, you can try to clean the data of race, but there are going to be these covariant factors. And so it seems like an almost intractable problem. But Angel, it sounds like you're saying we should be giving programmers training in sociology, ethics. I mean, what?
Philosophy.
I didn't want to say that.
What I love about academics is that, you know what the solution is? More academics.
Me.
That's really what the world needs is me. Yeah, precisely. So, for example, I'm teaching this class called The Politics of Algorithms, where I get a lot of computer science students at Stanford. And what surprised me, I mean, now students can always say things, right? But they're just like, oh, it's the first time I take a class like this. And I'm a senior and I'm going to work at Facebook next month. How come I wasn't trained into these kind of questions earlier on?
I think we're right to insist the answer is more academic. That is to say, I think we as Stanford and all the leading university, we're turning out tons and tons of technology leaders, tons and tons. If we turn them out insensitive to these political, social, moral, ethical problems,
We have not done the world a service. We've unleashed the potential creators of Frankenstein's monsters on them, and that's not what we're here for.
I mean, I think that, you know, technology, and we're in the middle of the Bay Area, right? It's just, they're not monsters, right? Obviously. It's just that, you know, they're very good at technical stuff. And this
I didn't call them monsters. Creators of the monsters.
Creators of monsters. Sorry. Sorry, programmers. But it's just that basically kind of social and political questions come as an afterthought, right? And I think that right now we see that Facebook, Twitter, Google are basically just starting to realize, and you know, obviously they've been working on this for a while, but you know, to realize that all of their algorithms have this like broad social and political impact that they hadn't kind of anticipated, right?
Tom from Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Tom. Assuming that you too are a human rather than a bot.
I am a human, thank you.
They all say that.
They all say that, even a bot. What's your comment or question, Tom?
I just want to make an observation. I've been working in the courts for many years, and in places where the judge would be arbitrary and capricious, the person who's going before him would not feel that what they did had consequences, that the judge was going to screw him over. And the thing that occurs to me is that any system that is willing to make those mistakes against the individual who's trying to make his life better is going to take away the sense that what they do actually helps them move up the ladder and that they can't win in that situation. Labeling is really a tough thing. It's like sending people to the gas chamber. Well, they don't do that anymore, but to the death chamber. I would like to see us find the one or two people in all of that who are innocent as being a really important thing over, is this going to just get more people that shouldn't be out there into the death chamber?
I mean, I think that, you know, death chamber metaphor apart, like, there is a real point here, which is that courts are overloaded. I mean, just like think about it. Like basically the number of judges and prosecutors and kind of pretrial officers hasn't followed with the number of cases that has exploded over the past 30 years, mostly because of, you know, repressive kind of laws that led to more kind of criminalization, etc. But, you know, what you have to realize, and as you're saying, is that in court system, basically judges and prosecutors don't have the time to give this kind of individualized attention to every single case. So what I mean by this is that we need to be careful what we compare the algorithmic situation for. And here I'm kind of criticizing myself, right? Yeah. It's like we're saying, oh, you have this individual judge who is paying careful attention to every single case, and then you have this algorithm that does kind of mass traffic stuff, right? But basically, judges are also so rushed.
So
basically, algorithms perhaps are not that bad.
No, so we can't blind ourselves. So we're talking about how we got to turn our technologists into humanists and social scientists as well, right? And deeply reflective human beings. But at the same time, you're saying, and I think you're right, there is real world pressure, right? It's not just that we're using this technology because, well, hey, we like technology. It's real world pressure that drives people to use this technology. And that technology actually relieves real world pressure. So, I mean, it's a really complicated thing deciding when to deploy this and not. You can't just say it's like we've done shows about the disappearance of work. I mean, if I'm a competitor and I'm trying to win in this economic competition and I can reduce my overall cost by automating this and eliminating the humans with their need for time off and this, that, and the other thing and fair wages, well, I'm going to do it. So there's real-world pressure that drives the deployment of technology. And balancing out those real-world pressures and our competing values, that's a really hard thing. It's not at all simple.
I think that's right. But at the end of the day, I think it's a matter of, like, your kind of political orientation, right? So are you basically a reformist and you're like, okay, we should take small steps to reform the criminal justice system because everybody agrees that the situation right now is not tenable, right? Like something needs to change. So are you like, okay, so let's introduce algorithms one step at a time to at least make things a tiny bit less problematic? And then, or are you more on the kind of, you know, revolutionary road where you're just like, okay, let's abolish bail. Let's just decriminalize a whole lot of stuff. And, you know, these are just different ways of dealing with a problem, right?
Okay. I mean, I agree with that, but I'm wondering, you know, given that the reformists, many reformists think, yes, we should introduce algorithms, but the algorithms have these biases built in. You've talked about solutions on the front end, training programmers to be more aware of social issues. What about on the back end? How about discretion? How about judgment? I mean, could there be training for example, judges to read the data more, you know, more responsibly?
Yeah.
Let's be your last comment. So give us your last bit of wisdom.
Okay, you can train users. That's possible. It's probably going to improve things. So in the case of legal professionals, having statistics and, you know, some CS classes would be a good idea, probably. Now, I'm a bit cautious about this idea of training users just because it kind of seems to, like, put the blame on the victims a bit. I mean, I do think that it is the creators of the algorithms at the end of the day that bear the responsibility of producing a tool that is not unfair.
Right.
Not the users. So, you know, that's kind of where I stand.
Well, so that's why everyone should take your class.
On that note, Anja, I'm going to thank you for joining us. This has been a very non-algorithmic conversation because there's no definite answer. But thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Our guest has been Anja Christian. She's a professor of communications at Stanford University, author of Algorithms in Practice, Comparing Web Journalism and Criminal Justice. So, Josh, you got one last...
I'm just wondering when algorithms are going to replace us. Well, maybe not you, but me.
Well, I don't know if algorithms ever replace English professors, but I don't know. But on that note, I will say that the conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is, with apologies to Descartes, my good friend, cogito ergo blago, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in the community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we might feature it on our blog. Now, no algorithm could possibly make this guy talk any faster. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes. So the other day on Facebook, I made some snarky post about an article I'd read about cryptocurrency. Somebody came back at me defending cryptocurrency. Luckily for cryptocurrency, otherwise my withering scorn might have sassed it out of existence, at least for the 100 or so people who read my Facebook posts, none of whom do business in Bitcoin, I don't think. Anyway, one commenter told me that when fire was discovered, I was probably a caveman in the dark poo-pooing the whole idea. Maybe true. Probably depended on what the weather was like when the original log was lit. If it was hot, I would have failed to see the need. If it was cold, it would have probably killed the guy who discovered the fire and tried to claim the idea as my own. That's how I roll. Same with cryptocurrency. I have money in my wallet right now. What need have I of Bitcoin? If I was broke, well, I don't know. I'd probably feel the same, frankly. Who needs Bitcoin when I can get a predatory loan? Thanks, Mr. Trump. So you might say I have a bias against algorithms, but it's seasonal, or it depends on what problem it's supposed to fix. If it gives me packages from Amazon faster, thanks, I guess, but frankly, I don't care. There are algorithms on the way that supposedly can read your face and know what you want before you do. Read my face, Amazon. I do not want that thing you think I want. If I do decide to order a CD from you, because no place in the free world outside of bargain bins even has CDs anymore, I can wait a week before I get it. You don't have to have some frisbee-hurling robot throw it at my face before I even place my order. I realize that many people think this heightened efficiency is amazing and cool, to use the hipster and techie word of choice. Cool used to be Nat King Cole in a skinny necktie. That's the trouble with algorithms. Bias aside, their coolness is implicit and inescapable. You can only roll over and obey. Any hesitation brands you a Luddite, and anybody whose job has disappeared because of algorithmic whims, well, you are told you should learn how to code. And should problematic problems arise, as with a program called Campos, which allegedly is used to determine the probability that somebody in a given neighborhood may commit a crime, it also could be racist, allegedly, but since the algorithm therein is proprietary, who knows? Their content is guarded by legal teams. Proprietary algorithms fuel overnight deliveries, risk assessments, parole hearings, travel itineraries, all kinds of things. It all sounds so magical, but keep in mind, an algorithm is nothing but a recipe. Could make a nice cake, could make a noxious brew. It depends on what you put into it. And overnight delivery is a fabulous thing, unless you live in a mountain or in a ghetto, in which case you shut up and you wait. The latest thing that is either great or alarming or both is facial recognition at airports. Who needs tickets? Smile at the camera. The algorithm knows it's you. Welcome aboard. The fear is this facial data is stored and could be misused somewhere down the line. How? I don't know. The great bugaboo, our personal information, is at risk, I guess. Read in a glance our credit score, yearly income, health, sexual habits, put that on the dark web, and stand back. It could also be used to target people as potential terrorists or whatever. Each twitch tells a story. And also that inappropriate nervous smile could mark you as a sucker for targeted marketing of self-help books, mood elevators, and diet supplements. Most of us won't care. Why? Because now we don't have to carry around a ticket anymore. Our lives are enormously benefited by this little piece of paper no longer to worry about. With empty pockets and clear heads, we take our seat with a steaming soy latte already waiting. That's right. It knows you like soy lattes. I don't like soy lattes. So you love soy lattes. Please, I don't want the soy latte. Take the soy latte. There's a bias implicit in algorithms in that we are biased in favor of having them, even though, well, we were never asked, were we? Algorithms say we already said yes. So drink the latte. It's your favorite. You know it is. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2018.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Can I get to Toronto the following day instead?
Computer says no.
You didn't even type anything in then.
Computer says no.